During the time of the Buddha, there was a monk named Thucho Patila. He was very renowned, very scholarly, an eminent teacher, so respected that people were in awe of him, and they never dared question him. One day he came to visit the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "Hello, Venerable Empty Scripture." And then some discussion, and when he was leaving, the Buddha said, "Leaving now, Venerable Empty Scripture?" And the Venerable Thucho Patila was puzzled. That was the only teaching that he received. So he pondered the meaning, and he realized that what the Buddha was saying was true. He was a monk, but he didn't practice. He was scholarly, he knew the scriptures, but he hadn't developed himself in the way that a true recluse could. So he decided that he would need to learn to practice. But he was such a great teacher that nobody would dare to assume the role of teaching him. Finally, he heard about a young novice that was enlightened. And he went to the young novice and presented himself and said, "Will you teach me the Dhamma?" And the novice said, "Okay, I'll teach you, but you have to be completely obedient. Whatever I tell you, you have to trust me. If I tell you to run into that bog and not to stop, you have to do it. And you don't stop until I tell you." Now the Venerable Thucho Patila, being so famous, he had very expensive robes. And when he was fully robed, the novice told him to run towards the bog. And so he did, as he had agreed. He ran in and started to sink deeper and deeper and deeper until he was completely covered with mud. And then finally he heard the little voice, "You can stop now." The novice realized that the Venerable Thucho Patila was sincere enough. He had broken his pride to receive the teaching. And then he taught him how we have to guard the six sense doors. And he gave the example about how if you want to catch a lizard who's gone into an anthill, you have to block up five holes of the anthill. There's six holes, you block five of them, and then you watch the one. And sure enough, the lizard will come out, and then you can catch him. And the mind is that sixth hole. We block all our sense doors when we sit here, not sleeping much, not indulging in sense gratification through any of the five sense doors, and we're observing the mind. The others closed off, more or less. Not much to do but sit, and it gets dull. But if we keep watching the mind, then we begin to understand how it works, what the process is. We can't do that as long as we are full of ideas. Full. If we're really empty, when we put down our arrogance, our pride, our self-view, our self-importance, and it's difficult to put that down all at once, but little by little, drop by drop, then it is possible, and we need heroic patience. It's not like worldly projects where you need a little patience, but then you read the manual and you can figure it out. But this isn't something that we can read in a book and figure out. We have to practice it. And with pride, it doesn't work. What's the end of this dullness or this pain? I want something else. That is conceit of self, demanding, tantrum. I want. So to sit patiently and wait for the moment to reveal itself to us, or to give us the strength to just stay for another moment, like we've never done before. Stay because we understand that this is the most compassionate form of patience we could possibly practice, and to empty the heart of all extraneous things, especially the poisons that usually drag us around, draw us out, and keep us occupied so that we cannot observe the moment in this way and realize what there is to understand. No reading, no external speaking, or anything else will give us the confidence and the trust that our own experience will give us. So how do you get the trust except from within? But you have to trust enough and not give up to realize that we have the key to open that door. Sometimes it can feel like total humiliation to be sitting there aching, exhausted, bored out of your mind, or just don't like the company or the building or something that the self-view will introduce that would sound very reasonable according to worldly aims and values. So humility is a quality to develop, and the courage to stay with it, to keep going and persevere. When I went to Taiwan to take the bhikkhuni training, there were 220 candidates, mostly young nuns and young monks, and we had excellent teachers. We were divided into groups of nine, and in my group, there was one woman who was 75, tough, and she helped me to let go the identification with the body not being strong enough to do the many things that seemed impossible. At night, after standing on our feet for hours, bowing, chanting, mostly standing, they would sometimes give us a break for 20 minutes, sit down, or for the meal we could sit down, or when we were allowed back down to our rooms for a few minutes, like a toilet break, and then up four or five flights of steps again at a clip, back into the hall for more chanting and bowing. And then at night, full body prostrations, up on your knees, up and down, up and down. We'd have to do 100 slow while chanting. I thought it was a way to break the mind. The way sitting for long periods helps to break down pride. So I wanted to give myself to this, just the way Venerable Thubten Patila surrendered to this little novice. And it was excruciating. Every bow, and I never thought I would get through it, but somehow the humiliation of not getting through it was worse than the suffering in the body. Then the next day, you couldn't stand on one leg so that the other one could have a rest, because somebody invariably would notice, because we had monitors that would go up and down the aisles and look at everyone. And you might think, why? But it's training. The external training and the obedience is part of the learning to give yourself to the Dhamma and do the best you can, even if it feels impossible. One night, when we were doing these 100 bows, we had these little kneeling stools, and we were supposed to put our heads down between our hands, and it started to pain me here. So I thought I would just bring my hands together just once, so it could be a little softer. It was dark in the hall. When I bowed, everyone bows together. It's a total harmony. And then the chanting was glorious. My forehead is like this against my hands, and these two hands grab mine and pull them apart in the dark. One of the monitors caught me in the act. Mind you, this was no great transgression. All I wanted was the tiniest piece of rest. In this litany of prostrations and chants. But then I realized they're watching, so I have to keep in stride, otherwise I might not qualify for the ceremony. And I was a Westerner, and the only Theravadan nun in the whole place. I'm the ambassador for Theravada Buddhism. A kind of pride came over me that got to keep going. But it was humiliating. Then the next day, my ankles in the evening were swollen from standing so long. When you have water retention in your ankles, it's very painful to keep standing. I started to feel sorry for myself. And every day, I would watch the clock, and after 3:34, I'd look down at my ankles to see how bad they were getting. Already, the self-pity was rising. And then I start calculating how many hours left. This is future, right? Thinking about how much suffering is left. Does this sound familiar? Then at 9 o'clock, when we were due to be released to go back to our rooms, the head monk would start giving a Dhamma talk. And I would wish he would stop because I didn't understand a word. And I thought, doesn't he realize there are older women here? He was about probably in his 30s. And we don't have the stamina. This very rational, logical argument was going on in my mind. Why we should end now? And my ankles were very swollen. And I was really struggling with this. And this would go on every night. 9, even 9:15, one night he started at 9:24 to give this Dhamma talk. And then I glanced across the aisle and I looked at the nun in the front row and her ankles were very swollen. Somehow, when I saw that, it completely took me out of my own self-created misery, my suffering. And then I realized this is practice. This is exactly the same. Here it is again. There's this suffering and the origin of it. Where is it? It's not the swollen ankles. It's in my heart. It's just in my mind. And I had so much compassion for her. She looked so noble and so regal. She had such serenity in her face. And I wondered, what do I look like? I must look like misery. It just really came over me that I'd lost the sense of devotion. Just by giving into the pain and giving into the view of, I can't stand swollen feet and this late hour and these endless times of training that we're being put through. It's a torture. I just can't do this. It all fell away. When we turned to bow to the shrine, there were tears on my hands as I bowed. They were actually tears of understanding. I felt such a gratitude. The sense of self just fell away. And I offered my suffering, my pains, my tears, all of it to the shrine. It didn't matter. I didn't care anymore, qualify, not qualify. I felt that the lesson that I needed to learn, I was learning it just by doing my best and using the sufferings, the pains, moment by moment as a way of practicing compassion and learning how to be dignified and whole in this. There were many, many moments like that. Of feeling beaten and in the middle of the sense of this little self, I am a beaten person and I can't take any more of this, some teaching would come because of my spiritual companions and I could keep going. This is something that I hadn't learned so fully In all my 20 years in monastic life, it hadn't gone into my bones quite like that. So the suffering might get worse. The mountain might look higher. But we are resilient. We have it in us to do this work, to walk this path. If we can only give up these thoughts of self-cherishing and practice compassion, certainly for ourselves, but also for each other, knowing that the fruit of this work, there are jewels, there's a treasure to be gained, even in the smallest instant of awareness, of this radical patience. We just make peace with one little moment of painful feeling, and then we offer it up. I was noticing the bell. This bell is just an empty piece of metal. And if you try to ring it when it's not perched on this cylindrical cloth cushion and balanced just right on there, and if my sleeve touches the rim when I'm trying to ring it, or if anything is touching the metal and I try to ring it, or if the gong stick doesn't have this leathery cover, and if I don't hold it at the right angle, if I don't apply just enough pressure, and I don't move it at a certain speed, it won't make the right sound. It won't make a clear sound. It doesn't have a beautiful song. It took me quite a while to learn, and I'm still pretty clumsy with it. This is wonderful teaching, this bell. And if we persist to rub and push and turn, it gets louder and louder. I'm not changing the speed, I'm just pushing harder. That's how the mind is. When it's empty, it's full of silence, which has its own pure sound. If we bring our full awareness to the moment and stay there, stay with it, just like this gong stays with the metal, and press it, surrender to it, give ourselves to it, such a richness, such a song comes. The pure sound of this awareness, that's what we are. We are that song.